Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Marius Stewart once again. Marius, good to have you back on the show again.
How's it, Nick? Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you? How is Cape Town?
All fine, thank you. Pouring rain today, actually. It's the first of real sort of winter weather, I think. So this is, you've got to get used to this and be grateful for it, I guess. But otherwise, warm spirited in every
it's
other way.
It's not raining in the God's own country, Michael, just to let you know.
Okay. Yeah, indeed. Up in Gauteng, we're having a nice autumn day. At least I'm having a day without electricity right now, which is perhaps why I'm sitting in the dark, as anyone watching on YouTube will be able to see. Yeah, but let's get into the news of today. And the first story I think we're going to talk about today is one of those great examples of how negative a policy black economic empowerment or so-called black economic empowerment actually is. And this is the DA asked a question of the communications ministry in parliament, trying to get them to say in writing why Elon Musk's Starlink company, which is basically a internet service providing company that uses satellites to provide internet, so you don't need to build a lot of infrastructure for it, why it's not going to be rolled out in South Africa. There are, I believe, about 20 other African countries at the moment, including Mozambique and Botswana, who are all going ahead with rolling out stuff to do with Starlink. However, the government has written back to say, quote, for Starlink to operate in South Africa, they require individual INCS and IECNS applicants or licenses to hold a minimum 30% equity ownership held by persons from historically disadvantaged groups.
Nick, what does IES and IECNS stand for?
So that's the
I'm just, I'm just putting you on the spot. It's fine.
Okay, no. I did read the acronyms before. It's the communications thing. Anyway, and so basically, as a result of not having 30% black ownership, in this case, Starlink is being blocked from the country. As Diane Kohler-Barnard from the DA points out, if Starlink were available in South Africa, children, even the most rural areas, would have access to information and learning materials, and others would be able to educate themselves beyond the constraints of formal universities or schools, which millions simply can't afford. So I think there are very few better examples than the way that BEE kind of strangles innovation and growth and economic opportunity, and most importantly, just dampens the life quality of poor black South Africans, the very people that when this thing is sold politically, it is supposed to be uplifting. Maurice, what's your thoughts on this?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, this would go way to actually empowering poor black South Africans, not just poor black South Africans, people in rural areas and so on. I mean, it's no exaggeration to say if you have a smartphone with an internet connection in your hand, you almost have access to just about some knowledge of some of human knowledge. You know, you can learn almost anything and, you know, any information you want. And I think it's, you know, the invention of the cell phone and smartphones and so on, and its expansion of the last 20, 30 years has been as revolutionary as the printing press and, you know, all that, and the invention of writing and all that kind of thing. So I think, you know, this is up there, and we're restricting people from, you know, being able to access this technology. And it's typical with BE. BE only helps a small connected elite. It doesn't help, you know, people who are actually disadvantaged. You know, BE doesn't help the guy selling coat hangers at the traffic lights. It helps a guy who's already connected, you know, whether he was lucky enough to get decent education or connected through, to political elites or whatever the case is. And we've seen that, you know, in any figures you want to look at, you know, unemployment amongst black South Africans remains extremely high, much higher than other race groups, especially white South Africans. We've also seen things like inequality increase since the end of 1994, but actually only amongst black South Africans. Overall inequality has actually come down a little bit since 1994, and according to Stats SA. And inequality within race groups has gone down, except for amongst black South Africans. And that's probably because most people are excluded from opportunities, and that's partly because of things like BE. So I think this is exact. It's a microcosm of, you know, what's wrong with the BE policy. And yeah, I don't know. One more you can say. Actually, it's it would change things for so many people who, you know, people in whatever living in Port St. John's with no access to anything. If they can get onto the internet and whatever, you would revolutionize people's education. People would probably actually also be able to start businesses and so on with, you know, cheap and pretty much freely available internet. But yeah, and also, I mean, there's a school of thought increasingly that, you know, access to the internet is a human right. I know that the Labour Party, when Jeremy Corbyn was running for Prime Minister in the UK, that was one of their policy, you know, in their manifesto. You can maybe disagree with that, but I think we're increasingly seeing that the world is, that people are starting to think about access to the internet in those kinds of terms.
It's so, you know, it's sort of the defense kind of put up against the accusation here that BE is a problem. It seems to me a fairly weak one. It's kind of the claim that, well, you know, how much would Starlink really change the situation? And surely we can get another company in there and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, Michael, that fundamentally misses the point, which is that a sort of ideological belief that we need to sort of enrich politically connected people because of the color of their skin is more important than actually improving the lives of ordinary people. What's your take on the story, Michael?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And for all the reasons, I think also that Marius has set out. I think of that phrase that was common when the prospect of an internet world began to loom before us all in the early 90s, when it didn't really exist, but there was a sense that this was coming, and people would refer to the super highway, the super information highway, and that phrase has now got lost because people realize it's not, you know, it's a multitude of paths and interconnecting pathways, and you know, there's no major super highway, but in a sense that idea captured the possibility, and I think this is what is available here. It's not so much whether it's Starlink or somebody else, it's that you're limiting the scope for competition, the scope for enterprise, the vibrancy in the economy, simply by putting this kind of constraint, this kind of condition on a very important opportunity. You're saying it can only happen if this really quite limited condition pertains, and it's limited to, as Marius has said, people either politically connected or already have cash and can exploit, already have considerable resources and can exploit the opportunity based purely on what they look like. And that comes at a huge cost to the greater economy, not quite aside from the very considerable cost, as you say, Nick, to the poor black people or people living in rural areas who deserve every opportunity they can to get into the kind of modern life and connect with the world and all the opportunities there. But the rest of the economy is also profoundly affected by this in the reduction of opportunity and vibrancy and competition and so on. One thinks of all the companies that would conceivably feed into a Starlink presence in South Africa and Africa. South African companies that could be participating in continent-wide initiatives in everything from call centers to education to marketing to goods and so on. And the ANC is quite happy to see that stunted for a purely cynical and, I was about to say charitable, it's not even charitable, a misguided ideological position.
Right. I mean, that's what's so ridiculous about it, is that even if you do get someone into the marketplace or something like that, the cost due to that reduced scope of competition and everything is going to be higher, which means that the people who end up paying it are those with the least economic power, those with the least political connections. It is incredible that the country has been sold for so long, and it permeates through so much of government's structures. Yeah. The system which very blatantly just enriches the elites, which is why on the show before we called it blatant elite enrichment. Maurice, any final thoughts now before we... Sorry, go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to add one other thing. A colleague of ours in the Daily Friend, a regular columnist, Sean Hagedorn, has often written about something which is almost counterintuitive, where he says that, you know, the unemployment, youth unemployment is such a huge problem in South Africa, and education is probably not going to be the route to resolving that. But the only thing that is feasible as a counter to its effects and to that unemployment becoming permanent is to plug young people into global supply chains. It's something that I don't really understand a lot about, but the way he explains it, that is how Asian economies turned themselves around, exploited the wealthier countries, found something that they could sell to a service or opportunity that they could exploit in that trade, plugged into those global supply chains and transformed their societies very, very significantly. And this is exactly the kind of thing that would be a very useful tool in that kind of process, I think.
Maurice, any final thoughts before we move on?
Not really, but I mean, that's all you can say is nobody should be surprised at this. This is typical, you know. There's something that could actually change people's lives for better, but, you know, to have to make sure that the correct ANC cadres have their fingers in the pies, so, which don't want to allow us to do that.
No, definitely. I apologize if you hear meowing in the background. Our cat has decided that it's very important right now to talk to me. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And this is, I think, an interesting little data point for considering the state of the country. And this is the number of dollar millionaires in cities around Africa and indeed in South Africa. So a dollar millionaire is basically if you take someone's wealth and you convert it into US dollars, are they a millionaire? So in other words, as a South African, you need to have about 18 and a half million rand to be able to be a dollar millionaire. Well, a study done by the world's wealthiest, a study published by the international investment migration firm from Henley and Partners, called The World's Wealthiest Cities, looked at the number of dollar millionaires in various cities around the world. And probably to no one's surprise, Johannesburg leads the pack in Africa and South Africa, having 14,600 dollar millionaires, as well as $2 billionaires and 30 people with over $100 million in assets. But what was interesting to me is how far behind some of South Africa's other cities are. And so the second place on the African continent is Cairo, with 7,400 dollar millionaires, so half of Johannesburg. And just behind Cairo is Cape Town. And I think there's a number of interesting things to take from this. One is that, you know, you'd actually, I was expecting a much higher number for Cape Town because it has this sort of fantastic, beautiful beachfront and this great, it's this great tourism city. It's this very beautiful place. It's a very nice place to live. And yet it's still very far behind Johannesburg in attracting these sort of super wealthy people who, of course, you know, often pay taxes of enormous amounts and are potential investors and that kind of thing. But also that Johannesburg, despite its kind of mismanagement and despite its relative decline, I would say, has maintained its place very much as the kind of beating heart of the finance, the money in our country. Michael, what do you make of this story?
It is very interesting. I was just thinking, you know, when I grew up in Kimberley, so midway between, more or less, between Cape Town and Johannesburg, although I have a loyalty to Cape Town, it's not a kind of diehard loyalty. But thinking back to my late teens, as you were getting towards the end of high school and thinking about studying and so on, the option was always to kind of move away, and it was either Cape Town if you were maybe going to study at UCT or do something in the humanities, but if you were remotely interested in business and any of that kind of hard stuff, Joburg was the mecca, and that's where people went. And I've had this sense, in fact, ever since, of perhaps the difference between Johannesburg and Cape Town, and you see it to be perhaps unfair to born bred Cape Townians, but you see it also in people who've come from Gauteng to the Cape, is what I think defines Johannesburg very much is a kind of can-do spirit. It's that It's a very driven kind of place. That's my sense of it, as more or less as an outsider. Whereas there is a contentedness and an element of complacency about Cape Town. And I don't know whether that's entirely fair in suggesting that this is why the figures are as they are. One of the key things, of course, is that Cape Town has never really had any major, major resource, no mining, no sort of major raw material export industry apart from food. Fruit is obviously a big thing, fruit and wine. And that's, I think, changing as the nature of the economy changes. The service industry is very big. I think banking and insurance are probably bigger here. But there is nevertheless that quality. It's something else. It's a quality of a place which perhaps arises from its origins. Being, you know, Johannesburg is kind of can-do, place where you make yourself what you want to be, and it just takes effort and ambition and drive. So maybe that's the what lies behind the number.
I think it also does something to kind of explain where, you know, why South Africa proves to be so resilient, which is there's actually a lot more inertia in these things than we think. You know, if you're someone with that amount of money, why would you want to stay in Joburg? Unless it was a place where there was already a lot of stuff set up. Mm. I mean, I'm sure a lot of these people do have, you know, second homes or third homes or whatever in nicer holiday places. But still, you know, Joburg is not the greatest place to live, especially at the moment. It's got lots of municipal problems. It's quite dirty. It's not. Something one would pick, and yet it maintains this kind of strength. Interestingly, however, and this is probably not atypical, but when you consider the size of Johannesburg, it does present a sort of quite interesting picture of the city, which is that you've got basically three suburbs, Hyde Park, Nyanda, and Sandhurst. Those three suburbs hold a majority of these high net worth individuals. Maurice, what do you make of this story?
Also, just when you're saying a lot of people don't move to, or Joburg's got more millionaires than Cape Town. I think one of the issues is that despite Cape Town's, I mean, great natural beauty, the city itself is, you know, a nice city, lots of stuff to do. It's just chock full of Cape Townians. So I think that's probably a lot of people from wanting to go there. But jokes aside, sorry, some of my best friends are Cape Townians, but that's a lie. I met some nice people. So I consider you a friend, Michael, but you're actually from Kimberley, so I don't know if I can count you. So, but I think what we'd also have to look at, though, is what these kind of numbers looked like 5 years ago. Because I think anybody who's from Joburg, and you're also from Joburg, Nick, you'll know, I'm sure you've got lots of friends and family who've left Joburg either for overseas or, you know, for the Cape. I mean, my brother moved out to the Cape in 2021. So, and I mean, we all know people that have left. And I was in the Melville on Saturday, and I said the place was looking, you know, it's a place that I've, because I went to university at the old ROU, so you know, Melville was a place I used to go to a lot, and I've still over years gone there, and it was looking very decrepit, you know, probably one in every three shops was boarded up. But that said, then I went to Parkhurst after that, and that was pretty lively, and, you know, it was looking pretty good. So, you know, these things also go through dips and troughs, but I don't think anybody could disagree that Joburg is in probably not good, such a good state at the moment, but you know, it's, as I say, these things also have inertia, and I think there's a lot of people who love Joburg, a lot of people who still, yeah, want the city to succeed. And, you know, it's just sort of going to politics for a bit. We've seen all these coalition issues in places like Joburg and Tshwane and Ekurhuleni, but this is also, it's part of the growing pains of democracy. You know, we're moving into an era now of coalitions. Soon South Africa's going to be governing coalition, and something we're going to have to get used to. And I think it's just, yeah, we're moving now. This is kind of another transition for South Africa, moving from, you know, we had the transition in 1994, we moved from apartheid to democratic states. Now we're moving from where one party dominant states to one where there's real contestation of political positions. And unfortunately, I think we've seen that parties like the ANC and FF aren't worried too much about actually getting Joburg working, but they're getting their hands in the cookie jar and so on. But yeah, I mean, and also with all these things, anything can be turned around, but you need political will and it takes hard work. It's not just something you can wish into being. So it's something that'll have to happen. I mean, lots of places have turned themselves around, but it takes a lot of hard work. And just, I mean, we've also seen a lot of places now choosing Cape Town as their, like, South African headquarters instead of Joburg. And I think Amazon's one of those. But I think more broadly speaking, probably places like Nairobi and maybe Accra and Ghana and so on, They could also be places that start overtaking Joburg when big multinationals are looking for their African headquarters. And we have an ex-colleague, David Ansara, who was recently in Nairobi. And he told us about his experiences. And we were saying, you know, Nairobi's really got to feel like a go. You know, Kandu feels like a city on the move, kind of the opposite of Joburg at the moment.
That's something interesting to think about. Also, just a last kind of data point here that you may find interesting. While Johannesburg has about 14,000 dollar millionaires, the wealthiest city in the world in terms of high net individuals is New York with 340,000 dollar millionaires.
Can I just make one more? Sorry, I know there's also a lot of resentment from Cape Townians towards Joburgers, and it's because Joburg was founded 230 years after Cape Town. We overtook them in about 10 years, and they're still trying to catch up with us. So I think that's also.
All right, let's move on before you annoy any more of our audience, Morris. Let's move on.
Probably if, when the Cape becomes independent, I'll probably be on the no immigration list. You know, I'll probably be at the Cape Embassy in Pretoria. I'm like, oh, sorry, you can't move there. Sorry.
just to add, I mean, elaborating really on Maurice's point about the hard work to turn things around and so on, I just happened to notice Victoria Coney's comment here in the comments section that Cape Town also makes doing business easier. And I think that's, you know, that's exactly what local governments can do. They can, and provincial governments, focus on what it is that keeps wealth and keeps the middle class thriving in business and so on. So, yeah. So hopefully, Maurice, we can catch up at some point.
Good stuff. All right, let's move on to our next story. And this is just, I think, kind of probably the last thing we're going to say about this specific aspect of the ongoing nonsense at ESCOM. Well, let me start off, put it like this. It was a great headline today, which made me chuckle because it was so comforting. Electricity Minister Ramaphosa reassures South Africa that there won't be a total grid collapse. Well, that's good. Anyway, while we're being assured that we're not on the verge of a total grid collapse, despite some evidence to suggest that, you know, we might be, President Cyril Ramaphosa, and this is another great damning headline, courtesy of News 24, Ramaphosa says he doesn't know and doesn't plan to find out which ministers allegedly looted ESCOM. And this is taken from a statement from Ramaphosa. He didn't say that directly, but he said something along the lines of, look, you know, when Andre de Reiter made those allegations about ministers and senior people in government being possibly implicated in corruption, he didn't lay a proper criminal complaint with the police. And, you know, we're not really going to take it seriously unless he brings us a whole bunch of evidence. And so, as Ramaphosa said, I was not briefed about the identities of the people who were allegedly involved in cartels and ESCOM. I am advised that Mr. Durator is a person that holds a position of authority as chief executive officer of ESCOM and therefore bears a duty to report corrupt transactions to any police official. Now, setting aside the fact that Durator says that he actually did, you know, talk about this stuff to, sorry, I'm being called, that he did actually talk about this stuff to senior people in crime intelligence, it's, I think, extremely illustrative of sort of government's attitude to the capture of ESCOM, the ongoing capture of ESCOM, despite its protests that state capture is over. To get all sort of very technical the moment that there's very damning corruption allegations made by the former CEO to sort of say, oh, look, you know, it's his responsibility, it's not us, and he's making things up, and how do we even know there's really corruption at senior levels, blah, 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 blah. Just indicates what we've seen from Ramaphosa about this whole crisis, which is kind of, I think, a general lack of seriousness. Maurice, what do you make of this?
But is anybody surprised? I mean, President Ramaphosa has pretty much had a lack of urgency with, you know, just about anything. It's like, you know, he's moving through molasses, basically, to get anything done. You know, everything moves at like a snail's pace, and this shouldn't surprise anybody. And
except for pushing the Rater out of ESCOM, that happened very quickly.
yeah, but that was also because the Rater was obviously getting, you know, starting to disrupt the criminal networks and other patronage networks that were had ESCOM in its grip. So this is pretty much a dog bites man story. I think, you know, nothing much is happening. Nothing's really going to get fixed. I think maybe we'll start seeing some real urgency when the ANC actually realizes if that there isn't any electricity, there's a real chance that they're going to get, I mean, they're going to get a bit of a hammering at the polls next year. I'm still actually not sure they're going to get under 50%. But I think if, you know, we carry on being at like stage 8 load shedding and there's no money to even burn diesel and so on, and then we're going to see, yeah, the ANC could be staring at 40% maybe. You know, I think that's pretty, pretty unlikely at the moment, but I think, you know, it'd be interesting to see a poll, kind of tracking poll and a sentiment towards the ANC when we're in stage 2 load shedding and in stage 6 load shedding. I don't think it would take you a genius political analyst to tell you that the ANC's favorability is probably much lower when we're on stage 6 or stage 8 than stage 2 or stage 1.
So I suspect very strongly that a lot of this is going to age extremely badly. The ANC has had, ever since André de Ruyter got kind of pushed out of Eskom a little bit early before his resignation came into effect, he has kind of been very quiet. He sort of went to ground and he's probably not in the country anymore. In fact, he said that he implied very strongly, I think, that he fears for his life. And as a result of his silence, the sort of ANC has been really able to fill the vacuum of information with this narrative that, oh, did he really report this issue? Was he just making spurious allegations? You know, was there any real evidence here? And I believe that André de Ruyter is very shortly going to give testimony before the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, SCOPA, in Parliament, where I suspect the ANC will demand that he supply this evidence. And it's very possible he might, knowing that he's going to be asked that question, in which case this is going to all look very bad. Ramaphosa claiming that he didn't, no real complaint was made. I don't know. Michael, what do you make of all this?
I mean, first of all, I liked Maurice's description of Ramaphosa as moving through molasses. It's this kind of very sluggish, loping sort of movement. It takes us nowhere. But I mean, how extraordinarily unnerving that he can simply say that, you know, it's not his business, essentially. That's really what he's saying. It's you know, it's between de Ruyter and the cops, and you know, if he hasn't done that, well, you know, I as the president, I have no particular reason to be concerned. I mean, that's essentially the gist of what he's acknowledging, and that's very worrying. But true to form, as Maurice said, this is what we've actually come to expect. It always amazes me, and I still meet people just the weekend at a dinner party who just still love Ramaphosa. They still think he's the best, or he's the best of the, you know, a bad bunch, and they just don't see this. But anyway, I think history is going to deal with the ANC, and we unfortunately have to deal with the consequences, which is a pity. But and certainly it'd be very interesting to see next week when de Ruyter does appear before SCOPA, what emerges then.
Maurice, do you think we're going to get another cycle of embarrassment for the government when de Ruyter appears before SCOPA? Or do you think they'll somehow manage to turn it around and pin everything on him, as they've been trying to do, I think, for the past month or so?
I think it's going to be a bit of both. I think there's going to be, you know, more revelations and pretty much stuff that the government can't refute, but then they'll attack de Ruyter for his race and for, you know, imagined ideological beliefs that he has. I'm pretty sure I saw Thabo Mbeki say the other day that, you know, André de Ruyter was a terrible right winger and all this kind of stuff. No real evidence of it. I mean, there's other things you can criticize de Ruyter on. He wasn't the best CEO of Nampak, I believe. And he probably made some mistakes when he was running Eskom. But, you know, they won't be able to really nail him on any of the substance, I don't think. And they'll try though. And, you know, as I said, they're going to, you know, so that terrible white man in charge of it. Of course, he wants to, you know, make a embarrass a black leg government and all this kind of thing. Yeah, but I don't think. Yeah, I mean, it's so predictable now. It's actually, yeah, I mean, South Africa's never boring, but it's also actually boring because we all know what's going to happen. Nothing really changes.
I think on that last point, the boringness is in the major headlines. You know, I kind of always guess what all the political figures are going to say, but it's in the small stories that South Africa remains a very fascinating and amusing place, with all sorts of wacky shenanigans. And I will still maintain that, for me, the most hilarious and also slightly depressing story of this year was the fiasco with the mayor of Tshwane from COPE, who lasted about, what was it, a week or something. That's all the time we have for today, I'm afraid. I would also implore all of our kind of regular listeners, if you're not someone who reads the dailyfriend.co.za, please do check it out. It's a great place where you can get opinion pieces every day, just talking about stuff going on in the country. We often have some interesting stuff there. There's, of course, this podcast. That's our base. And it's just a great website to get a little bit of a different take on what's going on in the country and indeed in the world in general. All right. Thanks very much, everyone. And we will, of course, see you next week on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great weekend.